Queridos hermanos y hermanas, dear friends, hearing this gospel, I confess, I can't resist telling you a story, a true story. A good many years ago, of 33 to be exact, I had a wretched little plant. It was scraggly, it was about 2 feet tall, a Ficus Beniamina, again, to be precise. And I was embarrassed, actually, to have it in my office as rector of the seminary because it elicited some comments from people coming in. So I put it out in the lobby so at least I didn't have to hear the snide comments of people passing by. And it happened that one time I asked a friend of mine, Franciscan sister, who is at that point now retired, who is a plant pathologist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's a plant pathologist, and her job was to receive in the mail, usually, leaves from farmers who would say, "Tell me what's wrong with my plant." And she would take a look at it and study it, put it under the microscope, and then say, "It's got verticillium wilt or whatever." So I said, "Mary Frances, you know, take a look at this." And she did. She poked into the ground, looked at it, leaves falling off. She said, "This is really beyond help." She said, "The root system has been so burned by over-fertilization." Then she kind of looked over her glasses at me with a kind of look that we all recognize when it's supposed to inspire sorrow and regret. She said, "It's just been damaged beyond any kind of hope. Throw it out and get another one and start all over again." Well, I said, Mary Frances, let me just try a little bit longer. Maybe if I repotted it, and then I started to fertilize it with water from my fish tank, which has a lot of hydrogen in it. And I moved it from one window to another. And, well, let me tell you, 33 years later, it is a wonderful tree. And periodically, I have to have it prune because it goes to the ceiling and out, filling half the room, so I call her. I call her and I say, "Mary Frances, this has gotten so big, I really need your help to prune it down. And I suppose I could do it myself. I suppose I could do it, but I kind of like to rub her nose in it a little bit." Now, telling you this story, I probably should have put it into the penitential rite, but it is an insight, maybe, on how God deals with things like that, how God feels when things finally flourish and go well. Every teacher has a favorite story about a little kid doing terribly in school, just terribly, distracted all the time, maybe sullen, belligerent, never quite getting work done on time, probably getting into mischief in recess or the back of the room when nobody's looking, just doing a terrible thing and suddenly coming alive when receiving some special attention, some special care. Who knows what's going on in the family? Receive some special care, maybe a little responsibility, some understanding, maybe a new pair of glasses because the kid couldn't even see to begin with. How do you know? But every teacher's got one of those tales of things that went right in a marvelous, unexpected, and gratifying way. And then as long as I'm given these kinds of examples, most parents know that first movement. When a moody, uncooperative adolescent, clearly embarrassed to be seen in the company of his clueless parents and dopey family, suddenly kind of shows a sign of young maturity and is cooperative and cheerful or whatever, those things, they do happen. And when we hear the story, or when I call it, we've all been there probably one time or another, so we recognize the event. All this comes to mind, obviously, because of the gospel. There was an ancient creed. It comes periodically. We even sang a bit of it in the refrain to the response to the first reading. An ancient creed in the scriptures of Israel that pops up every so often, and it is a proclamation that our God is a jealous God. Hanun v'rachum, gracious and compassionate, rich in mercy, slow to anger. And it is one of the creeds of the first covenant of Israel, a wonderful proclamation, acknowledgement of the deepest nature of God. It isn't that anger is not ever present, but when it is present, it's always righteous, it's always justified, and it's a last resort to get the point across. That's our God. That's our God. The gospel offers two categories in dealing with another problem, namely the category of natural disasters, falling tower. Lots of natural disasters in our world, whether it's the earthquakes in Haiti or Chile now most recently, how incredibly bad it was for a TV evangelist to just stand out there and say it's all because of our sins. That isn't the God that is proclaimed in our scriptures. But those things happen, and the disaster is almost beyond measure. And then there's brutality, whether it's the brutal slaying of those people engaged, Galileans engaged in sacrifice. Pilate took a look at it and said, they're probably plotting against me, and killed them right in the middle of their sacrifice. Whether it's that kind of senseless brutality or the senseless killing of those two little kids in our local community because they happened to see something that they shouldn't have seen. How awful, whatever that's all about. Or monstrous crimes, God-awful genocides that have swept across our planet repeatedly over the past century, and the Holocaust. God doesn't cause those things. Maybe permits them because of respect for human freedom, I don't know. Laws of nature crash. And even then, those are terrible mysteries. And we have to be very careful about offering some kind of quick explanation. Once visited a wise person in the hospital who was dying in a sense of self-inflicted tragedy, and he said, the longer I live, the more I understand God doesn't punish people for our sins, but God punishes us with our sins so that the consequences of bad choices come back to haunt us often enough. That's how God works, in the hope that we will understand what we have done and take steps to undo whatever the consequences are. Question continues, why do bad things happen to good people? It's a perennial question. Why was Jesus crucified? Here in the middle of our assembly this morning here at the cathedral, for those who join us by radio, it's a stark image, life-size image of Christ on the cross, a certain stylistic representation, but it's right in our midst. Why do bad things happen to good people? How do you explain that? I regularly receive confirmation letters. I mean, I get 2,000 to 3,000 every spring. And often, somebody will include a paragraph about my grandma who died of cancer. I loved her very much. How could God let this happen? Or my good friend from school who died in a car crash. How could this happen? Or my pet was killed by a car. How could this happen? And then I quit believing in God for a while. That wasn't the God I wanted to believe in. And then somehow I matured and saw a bigger picture. Or maybe I didn't see any bigger picture, but I decided it wasn't God's fault. The question, why do bad things happen? We have a few thoughts. We have a few reflections. We have a few observations, suggestions. And we have to be careful that they don't just become platitudes to kind of wipe away the whole mystery of it all, because it's a terrible mystery. In the last analysis, we have to say, why do bad things happen at all? Why do they happen to good people? We don't know. We don't know. Our God says, I will be what I will be. Standing in the midst of it all. Standing with us. And sometimes I think God standing in our midst, just crying. just crying with us, but promising to be with us all the way through into that final blessing that transforms us because of, in spite of, the things that happen in life.